welcome everyone joining us here tonight on the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Question and Answer Net. I am Roy, AC2GS. I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host, and Gene, KY2MY, will be your co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for discussion and to offer our answers, as well as promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its web pages. Also, we offer additional articles and reviews on many topics covered during these technical nets. We also publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder as a starting off point to discuss important technical concepts. Tonight's TechNet puzzle is posted on our club website. The link can be found on the front page of our website in orange colored type, but if you would like a simple URL to find it, you can just type puzzle.kc2rc.com. Also, we will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Just point your browser to stream.kc2rc.com. This net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesday of each month. All of this information can also be found on our club website, www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. By the way, an application is still available on our website. No question is too simple. No question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this net. Please give us your name, your call sign, and whether you have a question or a comment. The net will then address each question in order. I'll try my best to provide an answer, and Gene, KY2MY, will join in as well. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break in with the word comment and, when recognized, offer their knowledge or experiences to us all. If anyone has any suggestions for future topics of interest, please let us know either here on the net or use our email address, tech@kc2rc.com. And now I would like to introduce my co-host for this net, Gene, KY2MY. Good evening, Gene.
Thank you, Roy. AC2GS, this is Gene, Q Yankee 2, Bucket Yankee. Good evening, everybody.
Gene. Okay, well, this episode of the Technical Net will commence. If anyone has any questions or comments for the Technical Net, I ask them to please give me your first name and your call sign. Again, this is AC2GS Roy with the Technical Net. And if anyone has any questions or comments for the Technical Net at this time, please give me your call sign and your first name. Well, it sounds like we might have a very short and very quiet Technical Net tonight. Let me just mention a few things, give people an opportunity to either come up with a question or remember that the TechNet is this Wednesday and turn the radio on. Just recently, I released for the club members minutes of the last club meeting of January 2nd. Usually after a while, we put that on the website for all to see the past minutes. In addition, I tacked on a technical article which might strike a few as a case of deja vu. It was a nicely, I hope, illustrated article explaining why half-wave dipoles have different radiation patterns depending upon how far away they are from Earth ground. And I generated a bunch of images where you can pretty much see where the takeoff angle of the RF is depending upon how high it is above the ground. So I hope that people kind of read and absorb it and ponder it, and maybe at some point down the road we can all talk about it some more. Eventually, as I mentioned, it'll be available on the club's website for non-members. In addition, hopefully it'll end up in a couple other club newsletters in the area, because we like to share our stuff with other people. So that in mind, if anyone has kind of gone through and read the material and has anything to say, or if anyone has any other questions or comments for the technical net tonight, please feel free to hit that push-to-talk button and give us your first name and your call sign.
Net Control, this is Jason, KD2PUW.
Well, Jason, did you have a chance to take a look at the minutes and the technical notes?
Roy, yes, I did. I do have a question. Why is it, I'm sorry, I should ask you if it's okay to ask a question first about it.
Jason, feel free.
Thanks, Roy. So why is it that, I understood that, as you bring the antenna closer to the ground, you're going to get some losses from Earth, from the Earth ground. But why is it that the radiation pattern changes as you increase the height above ground?
Well, Jason, if you remember during our last episode, I said that the ground has two different characteristics that we have to deal with. The initial and most obvious is that the power couples capacitively to the ground and leaches away the energy, and that's just lost in waste heat, you know, warming up the earthworm. The second, and the reason why the different elevation causes different radiation patterns, is because there's a tendency of RF to not be completely absorbed by the ground, but be reflected from the ground. Depending upon the phase differences, and that's related to the height differences, they interact with the output of the antenna in different ways, that they enforce some lobes and destroy other lobes. And so it's the interference pattern of the ground reflection to the antenna radiation pattern that causes and modifies the radiation pattern in that curious manner.
Okay, thanks, Roy. That makes sense. I appreciate that. It's KD2PUW.
Okay, very good. If anyone else has any comments or questions about that article or the concept of dipoles placed at different heights above ground, produce different takeoff angles and make the difference between a near vertical incident sky wave versus a decent DXing antenna, feel free to hit that push to talk button. Or if you have any other questions or comments for the technical net tonight, please feel free to do the same.
KE2A with a question.
Certainly, what's your question tonight?
It's Chris. I'm just wondering what software you use to make these visualizations for the article.
I believe I actually even mentioned it in the article. It's called, I think I might get the numbers mixed up, 2NEC4. It's readily available. There is some nice documentation. There's a guy trying to, he's experimenting with an interesting concept. He's writing a book on the fly. So if you pay absolutely nothing, you get about, 40 or 50% of his book. If you pay him money, he gives you the most that he's written so far. And as he adds more chapters to the book, you get notifications and can download the further chapters. But I think the name of it is called 2NEC4. There's also another one, I believe, called EasyNEC. They're all based on algorithms that have been out for a couple of decades. If you buy the ARRO antenna book, you get a demonstration version of a software like this. And if you want the more powerful versions, you have to contact the author. And some of the licenses are rather exorbitant. I'm not quite sure exactly what's going on with that, probably because generally people don't buy it. It's probably a more business expense than any other, so they can charge as much as hundreds of dollars for the software license. But there's a lot of demonstration software and a lot of free software out there. So I would suggest you just Google 2NEC4, and you'll see a bunch of stuff on it.
Okay, thank you.
Roy, correction, Roy.
Gene.
It was stated, call 4NEC2.
I transposed it. I kind of questioned myself whether I had the numbers in the right order. Okay, 4NEC2. If you Google NEC and antenna simulation software, you'll get a whole bunch of information on the subject. Thank you, Gene, for correcting me.
No problem.
Is there anyone either with any further questions on the subject of antenna simulating software or the nature of height differences of dipoles make it either a distant antenna versus a near vertical incident skywave local antenna, or if they have any other questions at all, feel free to hit that push-to-talk button and offer them up to the technical net tonight. Okay, I will bring up the concept, the subject of the TechNet puzzle for tonight. I was only able to post it yesterday because I had to start building new pages since we're going into 2019. So I moved off of the 2018 puzzle page for the 2019 page. But it's a relatively simple puzzle. It's a diagram. It shows a block diagram of a single sideband transmitter. The microphone feeds into an audio amplifier, which then feeds into a balanced modulator, and a carrier oscillator feeds into the same balanced modulator. The output goes to a filter, and then the filter outputs a signal. And depending upon where in the block diagram, the audio amplifier's output is designated P, the balanced modulator is designated Q, the filter's output is designated R, and the carrier oscillator going into the balanced modulator is labeled S. And the question is, what would the probe at point S reveal? What kind of a signal would you pick up given that type of a block diagram? So if you want to take a look at the image, it's there on the website. If not, I hopefully made it sound reasonable. And people can ponder that, think about that for a little while. I'll ask once again if there are any questions for the TechNet, and if we don't have any, I guess we'll move on to the puzzle. But just in case we do, this is AC2GS Roy with the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. If anyone has any questions or topics or opinions about anything on the technical net, please hit the push-to-talk button and give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, well, I don't really want to kind of get to the TechNet puzzle this early into the into our little session, because I would like it to go a little bit longer if humanly possible. So how's this for a possible subject to talk about tonight? Many of us on the TechNet who've checked in attended the Ham Radio University this Saturday, and it was a lot of fun, I felt, and I'm sure other people. We took in different discussions. I had the pleasure of assisting Andy WA2CDL with his presentation on test equipment, and we discussed the nature of oscilloscopes and station monitors and all kinds of fun stuff. It's very difficult to say that much in 40 minutes. It's surprising how short a 40-minute interval is. I was just wondering amongst the people out there, again, almost all of them went to the Ham Radio University. If they had any favorite forum that particularly struck their fancy and was helpful for them and gave them some newfound knowledge. So if anyone has any particular favorites of the forums that they attended, please hit the push-to-talk button and give your call sign.
This is Jason, KD2PUW.
Jason, what particular forums did you find helpful?
Well, being new to the hobby, I'm not and new to electronics in general. I really liked the testing equipment course that or forum or talk that you were a part of, Roy. I knew about an oscilloscope, but I didn't know about the service monitor. Now I know that we did a couple of tests, mainly focusing more on the oscilloscope side of it. But what else could a service monitor do? I'm just wondering because it's incredibly expensive, and I just don't understand why that is, I guess.
It's sort of the Swiss Army knife of electronic equipment when it comes particularly to people who are interested in repeaters, because you can not only analyze the audio envelope to see if the signal is being overdriven, you can then adjust it and change the settings and see how the frequency accuracy of the signal is, because it has a spectrum analyzer built into it. It also has a frequency deviation meter, so you can see the gentleman in the back was very concerned about over-deviating. You can't really over-deviate on a single sideband or an AM transmission. The only mode that you can over-deviate is when you're using frequency modulation and you are driving the modulator too hard beyond its specs, it becomes nonlinear with its frequency modulation, and that's what's called overdriving the FM signal. So you can do that, and there's probably a great deal more. You can listen into the signal with a set of headphones. You can check the PL tone settings. It's a really jack of all trades.
Thanks, Roy. That's really informative. Looks like you can do a lot. I think I'm going to start with an oscilloscope for now. I'm not sure I could afford a service monitor, nor do I probably need one, given that I don't have a repeater. Thanks again, Roy. This is KD2PUW.
I would agree it's a bit of an overkill. In the very old days, when those first came on the market, they really couldn't be afforded by almost anyone. They would cost in excess of $7,000. These days, though, surprisingly, I don't know if you consider it inexpensive or still expensive, eBay, you can find them being sold on eBay for as little as $500-$600. So they might be of some interesting use if you don't, say, run your own repeater, but you operate on repeaters, and you like to check out how well they're working these days. It's not totally bizarre. But an oscilloscope is a very nice piece of equipment to have, and only you can decide exactly what type of an oscilloscope. Andy brought an old cathode ray tube oscilloscope, and even his station device was a CRT-based one. Nowadays, you'll find a great deal of reasonably inexpensive oscilloscopes that are basically LCD-driven. They're all called digital oscilloscopes. They use the digital domain. They have incredible specs for the amount of money that they are priced at. And a lot of the Chinese models have a full set of hardware features that are locked down through software, and software being software, a few hours on the internet and you find ways of getting around all those software limitations. So an oscilloscope is relatively small, relatively not as ridiculously expensive as it once was, but if you want to buy some of the older cathode ray tube versions, you can get it very low price at Hamfests and eBay and such. There are a lot of them out there being sold. So I wish you good luck with it. There's a lot of things that can be done with the oscilloscope. Andy was kind of trying to go through an experimental board to demonstrate the different functions. But again, surprisingly, 40 minutes goes very, very quickly in a forum. So we ended up talking about the other device of Andy's.
Yeah, thanks, Roy. I felt like you guys could have been there easily several hours, and I definitely was interested in staying that long. Though I'm not sure that you two would have, both you and Andy would have would have liked that much. But thanks again, Roy. I appreciate the answer and the information.
Very good, Jason. I mean, we probably wouldn't have minded to stay on because it was as much fun for us as it was for people, thankfully, who are listening to us. And we've talked since then that we might kind of ask for a double booking where we can put two 40-minute sessions back-to-back and present a more open-ended kind of discussion of some concepts. So hopefully, if we do this again next year, which we both intend to, it'll be longer and hopefully more informative than this time.
Sounds good, Roy. I look forward to that.
Thank you, Jason. Anyone else who attended the Ham Radio University have any particular forums that struck their fancy?
KE2A.
Chris.
Yeah, I found the 6-meter forum particularly interesting. I've never been on 6 meters before, and it has a dual reputation as a dead band and the magic band. And the person who was giving the presentation is the person who literally wrote the book on 6 meters and had a lot of wisdom. And talked a lot about the different forms of propagation on 6 meters. So I'm going to give it a shot. I'm going to put together a wire vertical on 6 meters and see what happens. I guess the digital modes are dominant these days on 6, but we'll see what happens. Back to you, Roy.
Good, Chris. In a way, I think the digital modes are dominant in most places, most bands these days. That's the most exciting portion of the band as far as activity of people jumping up on it and you know, filling up their worked all states and worked all whatever lists for their certificate. 6 meters, yes. I unfortunately wasn't in this hobby during the high point. Well, theoretically, I came in at the very beginning, was about the top of the sunspot cycle, but that was before I could get any kind of decent antenna or anything working. So I completely missed 6 meters as the magic band. You know, we now live in these unfortunate doldrums of the progressing low sunspot cycle, and it's more luck. I'm sure gamblers out there enjoy the fact that it's you're less likely to just hit a jackpot. I look forward to the next sunspot peaks when it'll once again truly be the magic band. But I'm glad you learned something from this guy. I had that on my list of possible places to check in, but there's so little time to do it, you have to choose wisely. So I'm glad to hear that was an enjoyable experience for you, and I wish you luck on 6 meters, because if you're lucky, then it is a magic band. But you need luck at this time of the sunspot cycle.
Thanks, Roy. That was one of the things that has my curiosity about it is that it's a little less impacted by sunspot cycle, I guess, than some of the other bands, and has more of a seasonal rhythm to it, where it really peaks in the summer, but it's totally dead during the equinox, during either equinox. But the DX that he was talking about was, like, to get DX in Europe was extremely rare, and what you'll more likely get is the trans-equatorial stuff. But anyway, I'll see how it goes, and back to net.
Hey, Chris. There is seasonal variation on all the bands because the ionosphere is also locally affected by where the sun is beating down on the ionosphere, and so when we're tilted towards it, our area of the different ionospheric layers are energized a little bit more than if we're tilted in the winter away from it. But the sunspot cycle, I think, is the primary force driving all of these magic band reports. I mean, you will have ductal inversions. You will have the odd spurious E layer emissions that will get things going as far as propagation. But all things being equal, I think we're all going to be very happy once the sunspots start to flash and it kind of charges up the E and the F1 and the F2 layers.
I don't disagree with you there. I think you've hit on a little something about 6, though, maybe I was trying to convey, but wasn't, was you get to benefit from some of these VHF propagation modes and events. And so for people, I guess, who have some time to wait around till the magic happens, it can be pretty exciting. I'm not sure I'm one of those people, but we'll see. Anyway, thanks, Roy. Back to Net, KE2A.
Welcome, Chris. And the benefit of 6 meters, it being the shortest in the HF band, the antennas are the least problematic to build and keep sitting there in the sky, as opposed to the occasional guy who really would like to have a 80-meter Yagi on a tower or something. I think there's one guy in Japan who actually did that, and he only has to replace the motor system, the rotator, twice or three times a year. Anyone else with any particular forums that struck their fancy that they'd like to share with us tonight? Okay, well, I guess then let me ask if anyone has any questions or comments that they would like to bring up at this time on the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. Okay, let's go to the TechNet puzzle. Again, it's a block diagram. It has the audio amplifier. It's a block diagram of a single sideband transmitter design. The blocks are audio amplification. Another block is carrier oscillator. Both of those individually feed into something called a balanced modulator, the output of which goes into something designated as a filter and then comes out of the filter. And the question is, if you stick a probe at the connection between the carrier oscillator and the balanced modulator, the question asks, what kind of a signal are you going to get? And there are four choices. Choice A is a carrier plus one sideband. Choice B is a carrier only. Choice C is a carrier plus two sidebands. And choice D is two sidebands. So if anyone would like to play, feel free, hit that push-to-talk button.
TPUW?
Yes, Jason.
So my understanding is that the carrier oscillator just creates the carrier, and the modulator is what mixes the signal and puts it onto, I guess, a balanced modulator, put it onto two sidebands. So I would say if you place a probe at point S, you would just get the carrier only.
And you would be quite correct. So that's the answer to this little TechNet puzzle. But let me ask you, since you were so good at that one, let me ask you if you have a picture in front of you. If you put the probe at Q, that's the output of the balanced modulator, what would you expect to find coming out of a balanced modulator?
I believe you would just get two sidebands only.
So the filter that passes after the balanced modulator is the way we choose whether we're transmitting upper sideband or lower sideband, because it's not very useful to transmit both the upper and the lower sideband, although people have been known to do that in the past. So that's the gist of it. A balanced modulator takes in the audio signal in audio frequencies. It mixes it with the carrier oscillator's carrier frequency. It produces a sum and difference sideband, but in addition, a balanced modulator cancels out the actual carrier oscillator signal, so it supplies as output two sidebands, upper and lower, and a later stage filters one of the two, and you're sending single sideband. So that's the secret of single sideband. It's been around. The balanced modulator was pretty much perfected in the late 40s, early 50s, and it took the amateur radio community by storm. Since it lowered the amount of bandwidth necessary to poultry 2.5 kilohertz, it had a lot more distance power than amplitude modulation had in the past, and many, if not most, amateur radio operators flocked to single sideband, and like all things, caused a little bit concern among AM people that their hobby had disappeared out from under them. But there are still AM operators on the 40 and 80 meter and the 160 meter band. They have a band plan that protects their little area. But at this point, single sideband is probably king of the phone modes. Anyone have any comments, questions, answers, statements about any of this? Feel free. Okay, well, that was it for the TechNet puzzle. I will put up another puzzle for our next little session, and we'll do it all over again. But before I call quits to this particular episode of the Kings County Radio Club technical net, I once again ask if anyone has any questions or comments for the TechNet tonight.
KDCPUW.
Jason.
Sorry to be asking all the questions. This one's not so technical in nature, but I'm interested in learning more about electronics and troubleshooting. What sorts of books would you recommend to get started in that?
I mean, there's a lot of self-help books out there. Ultimately, the first book I think I really digested on electronics was the American Radio Relay League's handbook. It is it's almost the encyclopedia of radio electronics. If you have any questions, it probably has the answer within it. And one of the first things I did when I was a kid was I bought that book. It was surprisingly not that terribly expensive, although it has gone up a little bit now and again. But it is a handbook that you will be using for many, many years to come. For antenna, they also have an antenna handbook, and I'm told that professional antenna designers, they might hide the binding so that people can't read that it's an ARRL publication. but it's in their library and they use it regularly. So if I had to pick a single book on electronics, probably without blinking an eye, I would say the ARRL Handbook.
All right, that's awesome. I appreciate that, Roy. Thank you.
Also, if you're a connoisseur of YouTube, there are a lot of channels of technicians who will kind of show you how they think about things and logically work their way back through a malfunction of a radio and finally pretty much predict what portion of the circuit board is involved, how they find out which component is the problem, and they fix it. Now, this is not modern-day electronics where people just pull modules out, throw them into the garbage, and replace them with a brand-new spanking module. These are guys who actually think these things through. So if you have the time, YouTube is a very valuable asset. Just kind of hone your ability to understand how things go wrong, which is very important in fixing them.
Oh, that's great. Is there anyone in particular that that you would recommend, or just in general, just run a search for it?
Nothing kind of comes up to mind. I will pull out some of the feeds that I get, and I'll send you a copy. There's a gentleman who works for Tektronix, the people who make the ultra oscilloscopes and test equipment. He's very good. There's a gentleman in Australia who does a lot of repair work on YouTube, and there's a few others. So I'll pull together a little list of those, and I'll send it off to you.
Thanks again, Roy. Appreciate it. KD2PUW.
You're welcome, Jason. Anyone else with any questions or comments for the Technical Net tonight?
Papa, November Delta, Paul with a comment.
Paul.
Well, Roy, it was a pleasure to meet you. I met you and spoke to you for a few minutes up at the Ham Radio University and enjoyed your 3D printing output. But as far as the other gentleman, I have a suggestion for YouTube. There's a guy, and his channel is Mr. Carlson's Lab. He's an electronic technician and repairs everything and shows step by step how he does it.
That is an excellent channel, Mr. Carlton's Lab, and hopefully when I get that list together for Jason, it will be included. The only thing that kind of strikes my ear poorly, and it's just being a good old North American, I guess, is he has a Canadian way of saying things. He calls, he has a strange way of talking about capacitance. I think he calls them farads, you know, microfarads. And he also has the English pronunciation calling soldering as opposed to soldering, which, you know, in Brooklyn we solder, but I guess in Canada you solder. But otherwise, excellent, excellent videos, and I agree with you entirely.
With you, Roy, if you get past the accents and understand soldering and microfarads, it's very informative. Back to you, Roy. W2PND.
Very good. I mean, that's the beautiful international nature of YouTube. You hear all kinds of guys. They might have all kinds of strange accents. Australian accent is nothing. There are some wonderful chemistry-based YouTubes where the guy has a rather slick, thick Slavic accent. But the information that they have, that they make available for free, is incredible. I mean, we truly do live, I think, in a golden age of both technology and information. Never before has that much accurate, useful knowledge been available to so many for so little. In the olden days, you would have to get friendly with a librarian or go to the New York Public Library that had much more books than the local ones. I remember as an intern and a resident in the emergency room getting these strange phone calls from guys in the middle of the night at bars to settle bets that they had, because that's, I guess, how you settle bets, at least the medical question. Nowadays, they probably don't call emergency rooms. They just pull up a cell phone and Google it. So these guys on YouTube are an incredible asset. Some people on YouTube are not an asset. Some of them are the dark side of the force. But if you check carefully and if you calibrate your BS meter regularly, they are an incredible source of information, in my humble opinion. So before we call this the end of this particular Technical Net, if anyone has any other comments or questions or closing statements or what have you, please feel free to do it now. Well, this net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL-affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York. We meet on the first Wednesday of each month. Our next meeting will be February 6th, sometime after 7:30. We offer a pre-meeting technical question and answer session, much like this net, from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. as time allows. We have a weekly 2-meter club net on every Tuesday at 9 p.m. on this repeater, as well as a 10-meter net every Sunday at 11 a.m. on 28.380 megahertz upper sideband. This technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesday of each month at 9 p.m. We have a weekly net featuring Yaesu's Fusion Digital Technology every Thursday at 9 p.m. on our club repeater, KC2RC. If you can communicate using Fusion technology, please join in. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. And as I've mentioned before, an application is always available on our website. If you would like to contact the host of this Technical Net, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this TechNet, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. Our website services were generously donated by the local Brooklyn-based web hosting company, 3 Alien Web Hosting, who we would like to thank. As the great philosopher Jimi Hendrix once said, knowledge speaks, but wisdom listens. So try to listen a bit more and try to talk a bit less. Okay, it's time to roll this all up and shut this all down. But we will be back to do it all over again on January 23rd. And you're all welcome to join us. I'd like to thank all the people that participated tonight, and especially to Gene, KY2MY. Without you guys, I'd just be talking to myself. So this is Roy, AC2GS, going clear and getting the heck out of here. Until next time, guys, stay warm.
Thank you, Roy, AC2GS. This is Gene, QYankee2, Mario Yankee, signing out.
Thanks, Roy. Thanks, Gene. It's a great net and very informative. Appreciate it. This is Jason, KD2PUW.